Bill King, if you want to. So it's my honor and privilege to be able to introduce Guy Leibowitz, who is now coming to us for the second time, which means I guess we did a good enough impression the first time around. He's coming to once again honor us with giving us a shiur as well. Guy Leibowitz, as I assume you all remember from last time, our noble reputation, is the Dean of Reitz of the Smicha program at YU, as well as the Rosh Yeshiva at YU, and as well as being the Marad Asra of Young Israel of North Woodmere. There's a couple of things I have to say about Guy Leibowitz, if Rebbe will allow me. You don't know what I'm going to say, so I guess.
I do not.
I'm just going to go for it. One of them is that there are certain people that get the title of a rabbi's rabbi. Now, I don't really know what a rabbi's rabbi means. I know they say rabbis should have therapists, so I guess the therapists also have therapists, so maybe there's a therapist. I mean, I guess the easiest definition of a rabbi's rabbi is someone who trains rabbis to be able to do this job. And so by that definition, right, Leibowitz clearly fits the bill. However, I think it's a little bit more than that as well. I don't know if you know this, but I've learned with you at least through other people, through intermediaries. And by that I mean that, like, when we have questions, when myself, other rabbinic friends, or other friends that have been with me through YU have different types of questions, we call each other up and we discuss them together. And you know, when you can call somebody and ask them a question, there's two ways of answering you. One is answering your question and just giving you the bottom line answer. The other one is actually taking the time to speak out with you the sugya that you're interested in. And I get to name the people later. But having the actual opportunity to be able to reach out to somebody who's willing to take the time to actually speak through the sugya with you and make sure that you were thinking about it appropriately also, not only allows us to know the right answer to confirm or deny what we suspected, but also allows us to be able to develop our own skills as we continue learning, hopefully, how to be rabbis. So Guy Leibowitz definitely fits that criteria of a rabbi's rabbi, of actually making himself available, taking the time to discuss these sugyas with us so that we actually are able to develop those skills as well. That's for me personally. For you, A, take advantage of that opportunity whenever you can, first of all. But also, I've spoken many times about the importance of taking time out of your day, not just when we offer an opportunity to learn in the shul, but also of taking the time for yourself to learn, to take more opportunities during the day when either setting aside time just for learning or while you're anyway doing something else, to be able to take advantage of the many resources that are available to be able to learn more. And hopefully, now that you're all here and able to have the privilege and honor of hearing Guy Leibowitz speak in person, you can actually take that to hopefully influence the rest of the year and the rest of the time when we don't get to hear Guy Leibowitz in person, and when there isn't necessarily a shiur happening in the shul, which, by the way, every week on Thursday nights around the same time occur, but also not just then, you're also able to take advantage of those learning opportunities. And so when you're Guy Leibowitz offers things like his 10-minute halacha shiurim, where if you're doing the dishes, you're driving somewhere, just small little periods of time where you're able to learn a little bit of Torah. And in addition to that, one more thing I would add, is that he also offers those opportunities if you want to spend even a little bit more time, actually want to sit down, actually want to be able to learn something. For example, Daf Yomi every day. Listening to Guy Leibowitz's Daf Yomi shiur, personal experience, is not like I can open up a Gemara and read it too. Right? And you can read through the Gemara, and there you'll get your Daf Yomi. But if you listen to Guy Leibowitz's Daf Yomi shiur, you'll get Shas Yomi. Every single day you'll have resources referenced from all over the place related to the Daf itself. And it just gives you that many more opportunities outside of just tonight to be able to learn, to appreciate Torah, and to be able to just expand the amount of Torah that we have in our day-to-day life. And with that, I'd like to introduce Guy Leibowitz to please give us some live Torah.
Thank you so much. I was very moved by your description of the chaverim speaking and learning and talking about shailas that come up, because I have to say that in my time in yeshiva, the greatest gift, one of the greatest gifts in my life outside of my wife and children, is a relationship with my Rebbe. But one of the other great gifts of my time in yeshiva is are the chaverim, the friends that I was able to make, we went into the same business and we're able to talk about things that come up. And you'll find as your career continues, you'll find how incredibly enriching that is. So it's a beautiful thing to hear. Last week, I was in Eretz Yisrael. I had the great privilege of being in Israel for the week. Not for the week. I was there for 3.5 days, and it was incredible. I went around to a lot of different yeshivos where we recruit Talmidim from. Recruit is a strong word. We tell them, stay. You know, this is the place to be. But if you're going to come back to America, YU is a really great place to. It's a really wonderful landing spot for a Ben Torah, or for that matter, for a Bas Torah to come to Stern College. So one of the presentations I made was most of it was to boys' yeshivas, because I work in a boys' yeshiva. I work in Yeshiva University. At the same time that I was there, Rabbi Shai Schechter was recruiting for Stern College, so he was going to all of the women's seminaries. But on one occasion, I addressed the Shana Bet girls, young women, from all the different seminaries who are coming back to Stern College in January. And I began by saying that it's Parshas Chayesara. Last week is Parshas Chayesara. And I said, traditionally in yeshivos, Parshas Chayesara is the time that we talk about shiduchim. Like in the yeshiva, if there's going to be a Musar Shmuz, if a Mashkiach is going to speak about shiduchim, about getting married, about whatever the midos that are necessary in order to find one's spouse, usually it will be Parshas Chayesara. That's the parsha that we talk about it for obvious reasons. If you don't know what those obvious reasons are, I would suggest opening a Chumash and looking at Parshas Chayesara, and it will become obvious. And all these young women were looking at me like, that is not the practice in seminary. In seminary, every week is the week that we talk about Shiduchim. It's not only Chayesara. So while it wasn't new to them to be talking about such a topic, it was the choice of timing was interesting. But the truth is, if you look at all of these parshiyos that we're in the middle of, there's a lot about finding someone who is a qualified person to complement you and your own kochos in order to be able to make the maximum contribution you can to your life lived on this earth. Right? There is a lot about shiduchim, but the truth is, when you think about marriage, you think about the spousal relationship. The marriage relationship is a very intense form of ben adam l'chavero, meaning every the same midos that make a person successful in all interpersonal relationships will likely make a person successful in marriage. The same midos, the same character traits that a person might have that cause them to falter in interpersonal relationships are likely going to rear their ugly head in marriage as well. And in fact, if you were to take any, you were to go into your local Judaica store and you were to buy any of those Shalom Bayis books and you were to read it, even if you are not married, you would gain a tremendous amount, just assuming it's a good book, you would gain a tremendous amount just about learning about how to interact with other people. And I want to share with you a thought related to not Parshas Chayesara, but related to Parshas Toldos, that relates to this notion of Ben Adam L'Chavero, and most emphatically within the context of marriage, even though it relates to this notion in a broader sense as well. There is a massive redundancy in the very first pasuk in this coming week's parsha. The Torah tells us, Ve'ele Toldos Yitzchak Ben Avraham, these are the Toldos, the offspring of Yitzchak Ben Avraham. So what do we know about Yitzchak from that pasuk? That he is the son of Avraham. And then the very next phrase, Avraham holidus Yitzchak. And Avraham, what's holid? Begat, right? Begat Yitzchak. Have you ever heard the word begat used in any other context other than translating the Chumash? There are certain words that, like, if you were to just try to use in your regular modern day English, it's like, oh, who's that gentleman, that nice looking gentleman next to you that looks like an older version of you? Oh, that is my dad. He begat me. You know, like, what? Where are you from? Who speaks like that? When you ask that question, you do not find favor in my eyes. You know, there are certain phrases that we use just to I guess sire. He sired him. But bottom line is, Avram Alidus Yitzchak means that Avram is Yitzchak's dad, that he was his father. But we already know that because the Chumash already called him Yitzchak ben Avraham. So obviously Avraham Alidus Yitzchak. We understand that that's the that's what it means. So what exactly are we to make of this redundancy? So obviously something like that, something that obvious, is not gonna escape the attention of Rashi, right? Rashi on the spot, of course, is going to address something that obvious, and sure enough, Rashi does. And Rashi writes, "Lefi shahayu leitzanei hadar omrim, the mockers, the scoffers of those of that generation, the clowns of that generation, who made fun of everything, who made light of everything, would say, 'May Avimelech nisabra Sarah,' that Sarah must have become pregnant from Avimelech, that Avraham did not beget whatever Yitzchak, but it was Avimelech that sired Yitzchak." And their proof is very simple. Sarah's been married to Avram for lots of decades, and she never became pregnant from him. So what did Hashem do to show, to demonstrate that it was in fact from Avram that Sarah had become pregnant? I mean, there's no denying the motherhood, right? Sarah was carrying the baby, right? So there's no denying the motherhood. But the fatherhood you could deny. And if they were married for decades and they haven't had a child, and then all of a sudden something changed, what most likely has changed is that she tried a different mate. And that's what they were suggesting. So what did Hashem do to dispel this terrible notion? Tsar cluster pan of Yitzchak domel Avram, the idua call Avraham holidas Yitzchak. Hashem made Yitzchak the spitting image of Avraham. There was no denying that he was the child of Avraham. They looked exactly the same. You know, sometimes people look at a newborn baby and they say, "Oh, he looks like this one, he looks like that one." I don't know. To me, all newborns look the same. They look. My grandkids are obviously cuter than most, but still, you know, you can't really tell right off the bat exactly how they look. But eventually, you know, you start to see it. Eventually, as a kid matures a little bit, you start to see that the person, like, I look at pictures of my father when he was my age, and I am very clearly my father's son. In fact, I grew a beard just a couple of years ago. I was always clean shaven, and very often in posters and flyers that they make of, when I come speak in different places, they find a picture on the internet from when I was clean shaven, and so I'll walk into a place and they'll say, "Oh, you look just like Rabbi Leibowitz. Are you Rabbi Leibowitz's father?" So I may even be my own father, but there are certain things that make it undeniable. So Rashi says it became undeniable, and the Avram Alidus Yitzchak is what everybody had to say. Yes, Yitzchak was Ben Avram. That's a fact. Avram Alidus Yitzchak is that everyone had to say it. They had to acknowledge it. There was no denying that Avram Alidus Yitzchak, meaning the clear evidence that the relationship must have been a genetic relationship, not just that he was raising Yitzchak, but that it had to have been a genetic relationship. That's what it was. That's what it was all about. It was to address the Leitzanei Hadar. Here's my problem. That's Rashi, right? Here's my problem. If these Leitzanei Hadar, if these clowns, these mockers, these scoffers, if they would just think for just a tiny little moment about where the fertility issue lied in that relationship between Avraham and Sarah, there is ample evidence that it was not Avraham who couldn't have children, that it was in fact Sarah who couldn't have children. Ample evidence. What's the most obvious bit of evidence? Yishmael. And then six others, the ones that we don't think about, six other B'nai Keturah. Avram had seven kids. He was able to have children. And they were fairly recent. You know, now when a major Rosh Yeshiva in Israel a couple of years ago, at the age of 87, had his first child, you know, it was hailed as miraculous. I don't know how aging worked back in those days, but Avram had a whole bunch of kids around that age. So even if you take a half a second to think about it, how could these Leitzanei Hadar have gotten away with such a claim that it was Avram's problem and that Sarah really was fertile all these years, and as soon as she found a new partner, so she was able to have a child? Avram had children. Sarah never had children. It's so obvious. In fertility, they always try to identify the problem, right? I mean, I just had a young couple in my office today where they were asking shailas about doing various testing because of fertility issues. So the first thing they do is test the sperm, test it, right? They want to test everything. Wait, why are we testing the sperm yet? Maybe the problem is not in the sperm. Maybe it's because they just want to know everything. They want to know all the details right at the outset. And that could come with halachic challenges. And we're not going to get into the halachic issues of that, but that can come with certain halachic challenges. Just have that attitude of knowing everything right up front, of knowing all the information right up front. But over here it was so obvious. So that's question number one. Then I have another question. Hashem was so worried about what these late sonim were going to say, that he did something almost miraculous. Like he made the child, again, newborns, it's hard to tell, but he made this child from the very outset look exactly like his father, be an undeniable spitting image of his father. My question is, when does Hashem concern himself with late Sanei Hadar and when doesn't he? Meaning, I'll give you an example. The very beginning of Chumash, Hashem says, Nasa Adam b'tzalmenu k'dmuseinu, let us make man. Let us make man? So Rashi on the spot comments, what do you mean? God made man. It wasn't us, there was no committee that made man. So Rashi writes, "Afal pi shalosiu uhu biyitzirasa," even though no one helped God, he did it all by himself. "V'yesh makom leminim lirdos," and there were apikorsim and leitzanim and mockers and scoffers and people who want to deny God's powers, who would use this as evidence that God needed help. "Lo nimna hakasav milame derech eretz," Hashem wanted to teach derech eretz. That whenever you're going to do something and you have other people that work with you, even if the buck stops with you, even if you are the final say, you are the boss, it's derech eretz to consult with other people. It's derech eretz. So Hashem wanted to teach us a bit of derech eretz. So what did he do? He opened the door for people to say that God didn't make man by himself, that God needed the help of the angels to make man. Why would he open the door to allow the late sonim to do that? Just to teach us a little bit of Derech Eretz. In fact, the Medrash Rabbah records a conversation in Bereishis Rabbah that happened between God and Moshe. And here's how the conversation goes. Kishamar HaKadosh Baruch Hu LeMoshe Rabbeinu Lichtov Es HaTorah. When God commanded Moshe, write down the Torah. Amar Lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem said, Moshe, Ksov Nasa Adam B'Tzalmenu K'dmuseinu. Hashem said to Moshe, I would like you to write, Nasa Adam b'tzalmenu k'dmuseinu, write down, we shall make man in our image. Amar lefanav, Moshe turns to Hashem and he says, Ribono shel olam, mipnei ma'at hanosin makom leminim sheyomru kishtei reshiyosein. Why would you open that door? Why would you give the possibility for apikorsim, for terrible people to say that there's more than one deity? Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu leMoshe, ksov ma'ashani omer lecha, v'kolarotze litos yeteh. He says, you write what I tell you, I don't care what fools are going to say, doesn't concern me. You see the problem over here? When it comes to what the fools are going to say about Avimelech being the father of Yitzchak, God is very concerned. And he therefore is going to make it, that it's going to be undeniable, and he's going to make Yitzchak the spitting image of Avram. And yet when it comes to fools saying that God needed help in creating man, that all of a sudden God is like, let fools be fools. It's not my problem if someone is a fool. It's not my problem if someone wants to say bad things. You know, there is a certain mahalich in that is often advisable, that when people are saying untruths about you and someone is starting a rumor that you know that's unflattering about you, that the best response is no response. Let fools be fools. There's an expression, sheker ein lo raglayim, that something that's false has no leg to stand on. It will die. It will die out soon. We're just dealing with a troubleshooting situation recently. With I'm not going to get into any details, but someone got in a little bit of trouble for saying something or doing something, and the debate was, okay, so how should he pull this back? How should he apologize? How should he? So my vote was nothing. Just do nothing. Sheker, ein lo raglayim. It's not going to. I'll tell you a story. My brother is a Rav on the West Coast in Northern California, in San Jose, California. And he's a Rosh Kollel there as well. And he was very close with a Torah giant by the name of Rav Nata Greenblatt. Rav Nata Greenblatt would travel the country, at the drop of a hat. He'd run all over the place in order to secure gittin for people and chalitzas for people to make sure that that the Jewish lineage remained as pure and as good as it could possibly be, that we shouldn't have, God forbid, any mamzerus issues and things like that. And my brother became very close to Rav Nata. Rav Nata really trained my brother how to be Masadar Gittin, how to write Gittin, and they had a very wonderful relationship. Rav Nata used to stay by my brother's house a lot. Rav Nata once told my brother the following story. He said, something like 70 years ago, when Rav Nata was a young rabbi, there was a woman who required a chalitza, meaning her husband died, they didn't have any children, and the husband had a brother. So in order for her to be allowed to get remarried, there's a whole process, a whole procedure you do called the chalitza, which, again, we don't have to go into the details right now, but it involves coming in front of a beis din, and the brother has to be a willing participant in this process. So the brother said, oh, my sister-in-law wants a chalitza, she wants to be able to get remarried? Sure, no problem. $10,000. Give me $10,000 and I'll do this for her. Brother, he was a terrible person. He was trying to extort money from her and hold this over her head. The woman called up Rav Nata privately, and the woman said to Rav Nata, I don't know if this makes a difference or if it doesn't make a difference, but there was something anatomically about my husband that made it impossible for us to have children. And Rav Nata got the details of what exactly anatomically it was that made. And he asked her, well, why did you stay married to him? And she said, he treated me nicely. But, there was something very obviously anatomically about him that made it, without getting into details, use your imagination, that made it impossible to have children. So Rav Nata called up the Chevra Kadisha that dealt with the body and said, when you were dealing with the body, did you notice anything unusual about the body? And they said, did we ever? Yeah. And he confirmed with the members of the Chevra Kadisha that what the woman was saying was true. And that makes it that the woman does not require a chalitza. So Rav Nata said, you're free to go. You do not need a chalitza. Immediately, almost immediately, rumors started. The brother-in-law wanted $10,000 to do a chalitza. This was in the 1950s. $10,000 meant something, right? The brother wanted Rav Nata took $8,000 to give her a heter. Right, that was where people's mind went. Now, what's Rav Nata going to say? No, the guy didn't have the kelim. He didn't have whatever. He's going to humiliate a dead man for no reason. He's going to humiliate this woman. He's going to humiliate the family. So my brother says, so what did you do? How did you stop those rumors? He said, I said nothing. Sheker ein lo raglayim. That which is false is not going to carry any weight. Ultimately, it will die away. The next news cycle will have some other scandal, some other thing, and ultimately it will go away. Why does God concern himself with Sanei Adar? And it seems from the Nasa Adam that he doesn't concern himself. And he says, I don't care what they're going to say. Because it doesn't matter, it's not the Amos. I'm worried about the Amos. I don't care what they're going to say. In fact, there's a Mishnah, Maseches Avodah Zarah Daf Nun Dalet, which says, Shalu es hazakeinim Baromi. They asked the Zakenim in Rome, "Im ein ritzono b'avodas kochavim, lama ino mevatla?" If God hates avodah zarah so much, if he hates idolatry so much, why doesn't he just destroy all the idolatry? He's God; he could get rid of all the idols. So the Mishnah says, "Amr lehen." The Rabbi said, "Ilu ledavar shein tzarich liolam bo hayu ovdin hayu mevatla." If the things that they were worshiping were unnecessary things, he would destroy them. Right? If the things that they were worshiping were things that the world doesn't need, so then yeah, okay, it would be no big deal. He'd be able to destroy them. But harehin ovdin lechama, they're worshiping the sun. So what do you want me to do? The stars, yovad olamo mipnei hashotim. For these fools, I have to destroy my whole world and come up with a plan B of how the world is going to be illuminated and heated and. I'm not going to destroy my whole world just because a bunch of fools decide to do something idiotic. So again, God apparently doesn't concern himself with the fools. Let the fools be fools, and the MS ultimately will prevail. So why Dafka in this one place is God concerned about the fools? Right? So far two questions. First of all, these fools are real fools, because if they think the problem was with Avram and not with Sarah, they must have missed the fact that Avram had seven kids already. And second of all, why is God so concerned about what the fools say? God doesn't seem to be concerned about what the fools say when he made man. God doesn't seem to be concerned about what the fools say when he doesn't destroy the sun and the Avodah Zarahs. And then a third question. The very recording of Yitzchak's birth so soon after the episode with Avimelech teaches another valuable lesson. Rashi, quoting Chazal, writes, Samach parshazu lelamedcha, Rashi says the most amazing trick. If you really need something in life, there's someone, lo aleinu, there's someone that's ill in the family, you really need a refuah shleima. There's someone that's in harm's way, you really need a salvation. There's a difficulty with tzar gidul banim, with parnasa, with whatever the things are that you really, really need. Rashi tells us a trick. If you daven for somebody else and you need that very same thing, you'll be answered first. That Avram davened to Hashem for Avimelech to be cured of the ailment that had plagued him. And then right away it says, oh, and now Sarah became pregnant from Avram. Avram's tefillah was answered for himself because he prayed for Avimelech. Simple question. What kind of trick is that? Does that really work? Like whenever, I mean, it's a game, no? Like if I need parnasa, so I'm gonna find the poorest guy I know and I'll daven for him and I'll get rich quick scheme. Am I really davening for him then? Who am I really davening for if I'm doing that? I'm davening for myself. It's just, you know, I know this game that, you know, if you pray for someone else, you get answered first. So what exactly, you know, what's the lesson? And if it's just that, no, you have to really sincerely pray for someone else, then don't tell that to me. Because it's not going to be sincere if you tell it to me. If you tell me that I'm able to pray for someone else. And also, if the great Maila is in praying for someone else, why does it have to be v'hut sarich la'oso davar? That you need that same thing. What if I don't need the same thing? I need something else. But still, I take all my energy and I pray for someone else. Shouldn't I still be answered first for the things that I need? And not for the, you know, why does it matter so much that I need the same thing that the other fellow needs? So there's one simple idea that I think answers all of these questions. And that is that everyone's always looking for skulas, right? Everyone's always looking for some way to achieve success. If there's some shortcut, there's something you could do. Rabbi Yisrael Reisman said in his Parsha Shir last week, he said, everyone wants skulas for Shiduchim. He said, I don't know. I don't know what's behind it. I don't know why. But it seems to be that like a lot of people met their spouses at a place of water. So why not go on your first date on a ferry ride somewhere? You know, like I don't know. I mean, he said that he went to the Statue of Liberty on the ferry to the Statue of Liberty on his first date, and they got married. Can't say that's why for sure, but you know, he said, it's interesting, Rabbi Reisman said that when he asked his wife to marry him, it wasn't like it is now where you already have a down payment on the hall and you already discussed it, like, meaning, and you know what the answer is going to be. He's like, you had to take a risk back then, you know, like you asked and the answer might have been no, you know, like you really had to. So he said he wasn't sure that she was going to say yes. And he said that afterwards, like a while later, his wife told him that she had a conversation with her father the night before, and her father said, what if he asks you to marry him tomorrow? And she says, well, I'm going to say no. I'm not ready. So, but she actually said yes when it came to it. So Rabbi Reisman asked his wife, why did you say yes if you were planning on saying no? She said, because you asked so nicely. So there is, but let me explain the depth of what that means, A great skula for success in life is to put the needs and the feelings of others before your own. And you'll find that even though it feels selfless to do that, and it feels like it has to be an extraordinary person that puts the needs of others before their own needs, ultimately, it comes around and it pays enormous dividends. It is obviously true of a spouse, Right, where a person has to, a guy asked me a shaila last year. He said that he was being flown to Israel for business, and they bought him a business, his company bought him a business class ticket. His wife said, well, once you go to Israel, I'm going to come along for the ride. They can't afford a business class ticket. They bought a coach ticket. So he said, now we have one business class ticket and one coach ticket on the plane. He said, normally, I would, of course, give the business class ticket to my wife. But my company paid for the business class ticket for me so that I can be well-rested when I get there. And if I'm not going to be well-rested, then is that called that I'm stealing from my company by giving my wife the business class ticket? My response was, nice try, buddy. a Jewish husband should not be able to sleep comfortably in business class knowing that his wife is sitting next to the toilet in sardine class, right? Meaning that it shouldn't work that way. Okay, but the basic element of marriage and really of Ben Adam L'Chaveru is to put someone else's needs before your own. Toward the end of the parasha, Rivka tells Yitzchak how disgusted she is by the local women, and she thinks that Yaakov should be sent away to find a wife. Where I come from, that's called a lie. That's a baba maisa. That's why she sent Yaakov away? Because she's so disgusted by the local. Why did she send Yaakov away to find a wife? He was going to get killed. Esau was going to kill him. That's why she sent him away. How could she say such a thing? Why did she lie to Yitzchak about the reason? Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein points out in his Sefer Tuvcha Yabiu that Rivka knew that Esav was interested in murdering Yaakov. How did Rivka know Esav was interested in murdering Yaakov? Because Rivka had Ruach HaKodesh. God had let her in on the secret. If Rivka's going to tell Yitzchak, I know that Esav is interested in murdering Yaakov, and I know it because God told me, well, obviously God hadn't told Yitzchak. And that's going to make Yitzchak feel bad. It's true, the wives in Tanakh often had higher levels of Ruach HaKodesh than the husbands did. Sarah more so than Avraham. And apparently over here, Rivka more so than Yitzchak. But it might make him feel bad that his level was not quite the same as his wife's level. So she fabricated a story in order to be sensitive to Yitzchak's feelings that he should not be made to feel inferior to her. That she should show him this respect of not making him feel inferior. It's a basic thing that particularly men do not like to be spoken down to and to be made feel inferior, but nobody, no human being likes to be spoken down to as if they're on a lower level. So before Rivka spoke to Yitzchak, she considered, how can I encourage him and build him up? Which truths can I share with him and which truths should I hide from him to not make him feel small? And that level of sensitivity toward others and their feelings is really a hallmark of the Avos and Imahos. And it's that level of sensitivity to defend the honor of others, to be cognizant of the feelings of others that are really the foundations of our people. So now let's go back to our questions. Rav Druk quotes from his father, whose name was also Rav Druk, that Hashem responds to Leitzanim when the things that those Leitzanim are saying are aimed at Ovdei Hashem, those who serve God, are aimed at God's people. When the things that those Leitzanim are saying are aimed at God Himself, Hashem says, I could tolerate the fools. I'm not going to destroy my whole world because of the fools. I'm not taking the sun out of the sky because of the fools. I don't care that the fools are going to say that I needed help in building man and creating man. I don't care. I can handle it. I'm a big boy. But they're going to go after Avram and Sarah. They're going to say that Sarah became pregnant from Avimelech. I can't tolerate that. Litzanei Hadar need to be addressed. Mahu Afata. We learn how to behave by the way Hashem behaves. And if Hashem is willing to say, I can take it, but I cannot tolerate when you do that to somebody I love. I cannot tolerate when you speak ill of somebody. You want to speak ill of me. Don't you dare speak ill of my family. Don't you dare speak ill of other people who I love. That's what Hashem was essentially saying. When Yeravam ben Nevat brought Karbanos to Avodah Zarah, and he was chote umachti as a rabbi, he caused lots of people to do Avodah Zarah, Hashem did not punish him. But then he went and he attacked a Navi named Edo, and right away he was rebuked, and his hand became paralyzed. Hashem says, you want to attack me? Attack me all you want. You attack my Nevi'im? That won't be tolerated. Chazal tell us that the day that Esav sold the Bechora, he had committed a very impressive list of Averos. There were rumors when I was younger that in a certain yeshiva in Israel, for more rebellious kids, that they had an Avera contest of who could do the worst Averos. Very creative. You know, sometimes like, someone is so creative to do bad averus, you're like, wow, that's kind of genius. You know, like they say that a kid went into the Beis Medrash and found every Siddur and Chumash and Sefer, and he wrote Yud, Kei, Vav, Kei. He wrote the Shem Hashem over here on the pages, so that anytime anyone opened the page of a Siddur, they were erasing the name of God, and thereby making every Sefer in the entire Beis Medrash useless. Pretty genius, no? It's an evil genius, but pretty genius, right? I mean, like a kid like that, you should figure out a way to channel his genius toward good things, right? So, I don't remember how I got to that. But yeah, Chazal tell us that Esav sold the Bechorah on that day. He had this incredible list of Averos. He was Boel and Nar Muras, I'm not going to translate. He murdered someone. He was Kofar Be'ikri, denied the existence of God. Horrible, horrible things. But what does the Torah mention? That he mistreated Yaakov Avinu. That's what the Torah mentions. That's what the Torah is concerned about. That's what Hashem is concerned about. You do all the averus against me you want. You mistreat Yaakov Avinu, that's not acceptable. Part of the concept of Mahu Afata is that Hashem is modeling for us. Hashem is modeling for us, think about others before you think about yourself. Think about what's best for others before you think about what's best for yourself. Rav Zelig Bengis was the Av Beis Din of the Eidah Haredis in Yerushalayim. And he explains the concept of kalamavakesh rachamim al chaveruv uhutzaruch leoso davar hunena tchila. He says, we misunderstand that concept. We misunderstand it the way I explained it before. That if I need parnasa, I find someone else who's really poor, I daven for him, and then I'll get my parnasa. Then I'll make my money. He says, no, that's not what it means. It's not what it means. He says, it speaks of a case where somebody else needs something. But if he achieves that which he needs, it will have a negative impact on me. And I daven for him anyway. It's going to hurt me if he gets what he's supposed to get. For example, I have a competitor in business, and he's been ill, and therefore he's been unable to work, and my business has been booming because my main competitor has been out sick, and I daven for his refuah shleima. Hu tzarich lo'oso davar means I really need this tefillah not to be listened to. Hu nana tchila. You're only going to find bracha from such things. From davening with complete selflessness, even though it could only harm you. Rabbi Reisman tells the story of his father. His father was a baker, which is an interesting story in its own right. But his father was a baker. Have you ever seen Reisman's brownie bars? So the son is Rashiva Tarvadas. The father baked the brownies, right? Brownie bars. That was the chat. It's not just brownies. It stays moist on the inside. Okay. So he had a successful bakery in Brooklyn. And one time, one of his competitors, another bakery, had a massive fire. And they couldn't bake. So Rabbi Reisman's father figured out the times that he doesn't need to be baking. And he loaned out his own bakery for his competitor to bake in his bakery. He said, what do you mean? These are my partners in feeding the Jewish people. These are my partners. Meaning it's not a competitor, it's a partner. They help me feed Klal Yisrael. They help me make delicious foods for Shabbos tables. If one is tzarich le'oso davar, it means it wouldn't be in my best interest for this tefillah to be answered about that person. I do it anyway because you're selfless. That's the great bracha. Rav Bengis proves this to be the case from the fact that Avram's prayer for Avimelech is the very source of this concept. Think about it. If Avimelech never gets a refuah, nobody will be able to claim that Sarah got pregnant from Avimelech because the illness involved the inability to have children. So if he stays that way, no one will ever be able to say that Avimelech is the one that impregnated Sarah. But it was in Avram's personal best interest for Avimelech not to be cured, and he still davened for him. And that's the model. That's the model of how we learn how to pray. So it's a fact of life that encouraging words that come from a place of love and care have a far greater impact than criticism and attacks have on people. When a person gets the feeling that you care about them more than you care about yourself, you're following the model of the Avos, you're following the model of HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. One of the things that we've learned over the past couple of years in Israel is that that concept of selflessness still exists in this world, and it exists even in the younger generation, and perhaps especially in the younger generation. You know, I'll give you two data points. Last year when I went to Israel, maybe it was 2 years ago, I was talking to the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Shalvim, Rav Yamer. And Rav Yamer said that there were some chayalim that had come back to yeshiva after spending a good amount of time in the army in Gaza. And he said to one of these young men, "How's it going for you in the army?" And the young man said, How's it going for me? It's terrible. I don't have a moment of privacy. My life is at risk every second. I am not with my family. How's it going for me? It's terrible." And Rav Yamer said, I immediately started to think, like, what sorts of words of wisdom and of chizik can I possibly give this guy? But before I could say anything, he said, "But why does it matter how it's going for me? I'm not in Gaza for me. I'm in Gaza for Am Yisrael." "Oh, you want to know how it's going for Am Yisrael? It's going great. Because we're going to win this war. And we're going to defeat the terrorists. And the Jewish people are going to be safe. So how's it going for Am Yisrael?" That's the question. Who cares how it's going for me? To have an attitude like that. You know, there was a friend of mine, Rabbi Cheskel Freundlich, pointed out that in Israel there was an ad campaign about a year ago that was running by the fashion brand, or some, maybe it's a cosmetics brand, Renuar, R-E-N-U-A-R, you see it in the airport, right? So there was an ad campaign that they had featuring soldiers who suffered from loss of limb and or facial disfigurement from injuries in war. And it goes like this: "You're about to see many more like me, not only in this campaign, but on the street and in the office. We are the beautiful, strong, moving Israel that never gives up." And then it continues: "Maybe you will even see us behind a television camera as newscasters. We represent Hachi Yafe B'Yisrael, those who taught us that we can never be broken." And in that ad, the closing scene shows a person who is maimed in the most horrific ways in battle. And the line is, "Lo avaditi natati." I didn't lose, I donated, I gave. I didn't lose my arm, I didn't lose my leg, I gave my arm, I gave my leg for the Jewish people. I gave my arm, I gave my leg for my country, for Klal Yisrael. That kind of attitude, that kind of selflessness is something that's built into our character from the days of the Avos and Imahos. So is this the week of Shiduchim? Maybe not. Maybe only in seminaries, maybe not in yeshivas. But if we want to really consider what it takes for us to be better, better Jews, better husbands, better wives, better parents, better neighbors, better friends, we consider, how often do I think about somebody else before I think about myself? And I'll leave you with one more story. I know I'm way over time and I got to get back to Woodmere for one more shiur tonight. But I'll leave you with one last story. It's a story I told a few times last week, and I love telling this story. I may have even told it last time I was here. I love this story. When I was a Rebbe in high school, years ago, in DRS High School in Woodmere, there was a Shabbaton that we were running. And before a Shabbaton, we were going to go to a hotel, like a Shabbaton hotel, you know, some place that the kids could tear it down because it's already torn down pretty much, right? Meaning, like, you just have to move the mice out of the way to go to sleep in your bed. But before there's, like, you know, cutouts of the dead body that was found in that room. Before the Shabbaton, we gave out papers with rooming requests, where everyone would request who their roommates are going to be. You could room with three other kids, right? So we got, you know, in class, he handed out the paper, everyone write down your top three choices. We'll try to honor at least one of them. Okay, reasonable system. As soon as I hand out the papers, I see the kids like, you know, oh, you, me, you know, they're making motions to each other. Well, me and you, yeah, and they're writing each other down. And I realize, uh-oh, we got a problem. Because there's one kid in the class, we'll call him Yaakov, who doesn't have any friends. He's socially a little bit awkward, and he says things that make people uncomfortable sometimes. He just doesn't... It kicked in later in life for him, thank God, but at that point, you know, things were not great for him socially. And it was obvious to me that nobody was going to request Yaakov as a roommate. So I'm like, what am I going to do about this? So I identified who is most likely to, if I ask, to put Yaakov's name down. So I waited till the class was over. Everyone handed in the sheets. I said, Stephen, can you do me a favor? Stay behind. Now, Stephen was a great kid. Stephen was like, everyone loved Stephen because he was like smart, but not like so smart that he intimidates you, you know, or like he makes you feel stupid. He was like a decent athlete, but not like the best, you know, and he was funny and easygoing and all the great qualities. So, and he was so sweet. So I said, Stephen, stay behind. Stephen didn't get in so much trouble in high school. He was a little surprised that he was asked to stay behind. Everyone left. I said, Stephen, just do me a favor. I'm sure no one requested Yaakov on the roomie request. Can you take back your paper and write Yaakov as one of your requests? And he said, Rebbe, what do you think of me? I said, well, I think, in fact, the whole class, I thought you'd be the most likely to listen to such a, you know, to accommodate such a request. He said, can you do me a favor? Can you find my sheet? And I found his sheet in the pile. I hadn't looked at it before. Three lines. Where he could have three requests. Yaakov, Yaakov, Yaakov. Every other kid in that class, when they got their sheet, they thought about, what can I do that will make my experience as good as possible? What can I do for myself? How can I make sure that I enjoy myself? One kid got a piece of paper and said, this is an opportunity to make somebody else feel good. This is an opportunity to help out someone else. And that's the midah of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. That's the sensitivity of Rivka when she talks to Yitzchak to make him feel good. Not that he didn't have Ruach HaKodesh. That's the midah we learn from God himself when he says, you can do whatever you want to me, but you do not speak ill of those that I love. We take care of the people around us. First, lo avadati, notati. That is a major, major element of what it means to be a Jew. Okay, have a wonderful